John chapter 2 this morning. We're continuing our brief look through this gospel here, and I am looking forward to these weeks together in John's gospel, and we find ourselves in John chapter 2. And again, just setting some expectations, this is not an exhaustive exposition of the gospel of John at all. Really, the approach here that we're taking in this particular series is to highlight and emphasize the relational emphasis that is found in John 2, that Jesus has come to bring us into an encounter with God, to know and relate with God. He is God with us. And here we find ourselves in John chapter 2. And I'm not sure what you think about this miracle. This is kind of one of these miracles that, quote-unquote, good Baptists just kind of, endure, because you have Jesus creating wine, and we're kind of, sometimes Christians don't quite know what to do with that, and so we go through these mental gymnastics to try to make it so that Jesus did something else. He made some sort of grape juice, like substance, or something other than wine. I just want to walk into this kind of in the front end and just say, folks, Jesus made wine, okay? He made wine. And you're thinking, so what is going on here in John chapter 2? In fact, what's interesting is as we read this, we find out in verse 11 of chapter 2, you see, this is kind of the summary of what's happened here. It says, Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee. He revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. So as John is writing this gospel to give us as readers the proof and the confidence that we can know who Jesus really is, that we can believe in him, and by believing in him, we could have what? Okay, we're not doing so well today, okay? John chapter 20, verse 31, remember last week? By believing in his name, we could have what? Life. And last week, we talked about the Logos, and what is life? What is the meaning of life? And how it's attached to and understood through Christ. So here we have John giving us the first sign. What would you be expecting the first sign of Jesus to be? Maybe healing. Maybe exorcising a demon or casting out a demon. Okay, I know the word exorcism sounds weird. It's like he's going to gym class. But casting out a demon. Or maybe you would think it would be like a resurrection. Like something dramatic and just amazing. And here the first sign that the Apostle John gives us is Jesus turning water into wine. What? Why? What is going on here? Is this surprising to you at all that this is what John would start with? Now, as we look at this, Jesus going public, so to speak, it means that John understands that there is something very important for us to understand about Jesus through this sign. There's something important being revealed about Jesus in this miracle, which means that we need to not just think that this is incidental or that it's kind of, well, let's just get past this miracle and then we'll get into the really meaty stuff about him healing people and casting out demons and raising people from the dead. That's the stuff of Jesus, right? No, this is central. It's not incidental. It's central. But understanding who Jesus is. So what is it that we can learn about Jesus here in John chapter 2? Well, there's a lot, okay? Today, we're going to learn this. Jesus has come to bring joy. He's come to bring excessive joy. He has come to bring an eternal joy. Jesus is going to transform the cold water of religion into the rich wine of joyful relationship. That's how I heard it described, and it just stuck in my heart. He's come to transform the cold water of religion into the rich wine of joyful relationship. And this is what we're presented with. We're presented with this contrast here of something lacking and then Jesus providing something in abundance where there was lack. And what we find is that there is this shortage of joy, the shortage that is being talked about here in John chapter 2 that's symbolized here with the wine. This context in verse 3, he tells us where he is. He tells us that he's at a wedding. Do I sound particularly loud to you? Okay, I sound loud to myself, sorry. It just was distracting to me now, and I thought, I can't be distracted this whole time. So do whatever you need to. He sets the context of this first century wedding taking place, and there's this wine. Of course, this wedding would have lasted for days. It wasn't just like a two-hour event. It would have been a day. It would have been days of celebration together in this village and the families. And so what we have going on here is that there is this layer of meaning in the wine running out, that there's something deeper going on here, which is why some of the language in the conversation here seems bizarre. Because the wine is running out, and then Mary learns about this, and Mary goes to Jesus and says, hey, we have a problem, the wine is running out. And then Jesus responds to her in this really almost kind of abrupt, borderline disrespectful way, woman, this is not my hour. And why is she going to Jesus? He's not the head waiter. I mean, he's just a guest there. So it's this strange, kind of weird story that we're trying to puzzle our way through, which means that there's something else going on in here. It's more than just a wedding, more than just an issue of wine running out. What we find here is that this is really an analogy of our human condition that John is presenting, and he's showing us something about who Jesus is in answering the need of our human condition. The problem represented here is the problem that is present in every human heart in this sin-cursed world. The problem that we have, that we all share, is that every feast we throw, and every party we plan, and every pursuit that we chase, eventually it runs out. It dries up. It's not enough. The career that once thrilled you doesn't satisfy, or the relationship that promised everything becomes ordinary or routine or irritating. Well, the dream that kept you climbing higher and higher suddenly leaves you someday thinking, is this all there is? We are a people with a shortage of joy. Yet we live in a culture that is obsessed with it, the pursuit of it, and spends gobs of money trying to find it, and advertises it, and promises it to us in innumerable ways, and yet we find ourselves still panting and thirsty at the end of the day. The wine of life keeps running out. C.S. Lewis called it this argument of joy in his book, Surprised by Joy. He says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. You see, we might think that, well, we have this thirst in us, so we need to distance ourselves from that thirst. Well, that's what the Greek Stoics said to do. Don't get attached to anything. Don't put your heart in anything. Stay removed, stay aloof, and you'll be okay. But that's not the issue. The issue for us is not that we have a thirst for joy. The issue is that we keep going to the wrong wells to satisfy that thirst. Mary, the mother of Jesus, seems to know this. And she seems to know that Jesus is the place to go. He's the one to go to. Because she learns about this problem, and I think that's some of the enigma here, right? She learns about it, and it's like she knows, hey, there's a lack, there's a shortage. I know somebody that is of abundance. And so she says, hey, Jesus, they've run out of wine. In fact, he's not the head waiter. This is so bizarre. He's not the head waiter. He's not the master of the feast. He's not the wine guy. And yet she goes to him, and all through John's gospel, you're going to see circumstances and situations where Jesus seems to be not the person you would think to go to, not the expert. It's not his field, and people keep turning to him. For example, you have that happening here at a feast. He's not an event coordinator. Or then you have disciples who have been fishermen for their life. They're skilled on the waters, and they're in a storm, and when they have used up all of their skilled expertise, who do they call out to? The rabbi. It's like, why are you talking to that guy? All throughout this book, you see circumstances and situations where people are at their wit's end, and they're like, now what do we do? And they seem to be like, he has an abundance. That's the story that John is presenting us. And so in verse 4, it's really a puzzler to our modern ears, right? Jesus says to her, to his mom, woman, what does this have to do with me? Now, okay, mothers, would you feel cared for if this was ever said to you. All right, I see people smiling and shaking their heads. Some of you are afraid to say anything because you're like, it's Jesus, so it has to be okay, right? So let me try to resolve some of that tension. Do you remember at the very, if you're a Christian, you've read your Bible, if you're not a Christian, just listen in, but at the end of the story of Jesus' life, Jesus is on the cross, dying. And he calls his mother, he addresses her in the same language. And the Apostle John is there, and he says to her, "Woman, this is your son. John, this is your mother." It was not, this term is lost in our modern day English ears. It was not Jesus being aloof and disrespectful to her at all. But his response to her then, when he says, "What does this have to do with me?" he explains what he means. He says in the next phrase, you see that? "My hour has not yet come." And again, our modern ears are like, I don't understand this. Like, what is happening? Yet his mom knows, like, he's the guy. And I just love her simple trust and faith. She doesn't argue with him. She doesn't beg him. She just looks at the servant and says, just do what he tells you. It's like she knows, right? Mothers know best, right? She just knows that just do what he tells you. So what's going on here in this response that seems to be so cryptic to his mother, this hour has not yet come? What is Jesus thinking about? Well, the obvious answer is he's thinking about his hour. That doesn't sound helpful, does it? Well, what's his hour? Well, in the Gospel of John, that term, hour, in reference to Jesus, is a significant, it has a technical or a significant meaning. You can see it in John 7, you can see it in John 8, you see it again in John 12, you hear it again in John 13, and each time that word is used, it describes, or it's a reference to the cross work of Jesus, the sacrificial atoning death of Jesus. That's what it's referring to. And you're like, well, how then is what's going on in this wedding in Cana with wine running out have anything to do with Jesus and his hour of atoning death and sacrificial death, accomplishing the great saving acts of God for us? How are these connected at all? I think they're connected because this is happening at a wedding. And it seems that Jesus is thinking, he is consumed in his mind and his heart about what is going to be required to bring wine or joy to the wedding of all weddings. It seems that he is thinking about this much bigger wedding that he has come into the world to make true. This wedding of all weddings that Jesus is thinking about is what each wedding here in the earth is kind of a flicker or a glimmer of, but it's described in Revelation chapter 19. And it says, "Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the roar of many waters, and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder, crying out, 'Hallelujah! For the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory.' Why? For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready." And then down in verse 9 it says, "And the angel said to me, 'Write this. Blessed or happy are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb.' And he said to me, 'These are the true words of God.'" Do you know what it's going to take to make that marriage supper of the Lamb a reality? It's going to take the hour of Jesus. It's going to require nothing less than God spilling his blood in the atoning death to make it possible for you and I to experience this great wedding supper, this God throws the best parties. It's going to take nothing less than God spilling his blood in atoning sacrifice to make that supper celebration possible. And in fact, if Jesus during the Last Supper, when he's observing that with his disciples and he has the bread and he says, "This is my what? Body, which is broken for you." And then he takes the cup of wine and he says, "And this wine is my blood of the new covenant." You see how this is all connected. This is what is consuming Jesus. The saving acts of Jesus are central in view here. And I'll point it out, I'll prove it to you even more, because look at verse 6. Here's again, it seems like this odd detail, but there's these 6 stone water jars that are standing there. And they're used for this Jewish ceremonial washing. And by the way, that's not just a throwaway detail. It's not just that Jesus looked around and was like, I don't know what to do. Whoa, look at that. There's some vessels of water over here. And he's just using something convenient. No, it was very deliberate. Because these jars symbolize this old covenant system of purification. It was a reminder of this endless need to have the cycle of washing and cleansing. And every time you had to do that, it was a reminder that you weren't clean. That you're not ready to meet with God. There's a cleansing that's required in order for you to have an audience and an encounter with God. And Jesus says, okay, I'm going to take the very symbols, the very vessels that are a reminder of this old covenant, of this barrier between you and God. And Jesus says, I'm going to take those very vessels and I'm going to fill them with something new. In fact, Jesus also taught about how he is going to take new wine and not put it into old wineskins. Do you remember that analogy? You see how there's this. Jesus isn't, all this is through this whole gospel account. It's beautiful. He takes this water that was used for washing, that was a reminder of this barrier between humans and God, and he turns it into the wine of celebration. The containers of law become filled with grace. The symbols of guilt become symbols of joy. This is what Jesus does when he turns water into wine. Jesus is showing us what happens when he shows up. When he shows up, when he steps into the middle of human religion, what happens is he turns it into a relationship. This is why he has come. He's not come to enhance religion. He has come to secure a relationship with you. So the old religion was saying, purify yourself so you can come to God. Wash yourself. Keep washing yourself to come to God. Jesus says, I am going to wash you and purify you with my blood. And by the way, in John 13, what does Jesus do to the disciples right before they observe the Lord's Supper? He does something so shocking that his disciples even object to it. He puts on an apron and he fills a basin of water. And what does he do? He washes their feet. All of this, Jesus is showing, John is showing us who Jesus really is. That's why the wine that comes from the purification jars, this water of religion, becomes the wine of the gospel. And look at verse 10, right? The master of the banquet, these servants do this. And by the way, Jesus doesn't just make a little bit of wine. There are 6 jars, 20 to 30 gallons, maybe an average of 150 gallons of wine. Does that seem excessive? And we're like, well, we don't know how many people are there. We don't know how early this happened, but they've been using wine already, so it probably wasn't the beginning of this. It was near the end, the head waiter says. Normally you reserve it. And so what happens here is he makes this excessive amount of wine in verse 10, and he says, you saved the best till now. That was the judgment of the head waiter. And that's the story of the gospel. God isn't stingy. God is excessive in his giving of grace. The story of the gospel is the story of every believer, because in Christ, the best is yet to come. Even now in this world where the parties still end and the glasses run dry, he is giving us a taste, a sip of this coming feast. In fact, this isn't a new idea. Remember Psalm 23? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. What does the shepherd do? He lays a table, a banquet, right? In the presence of my enemies. That's what it's referred to. All through the scriptures, God keeps showing us who he is. He throws the best parties. He brings the best joy. He gives you the best wine. He's offering you the best celebration in himself. He brings a joy that suffering cannot erase. He brings a hope that death cannot silence. In fact, Jesus refers to Isaiah as he is the fulfillment of the prophecies of Isaiah. Prophecies like this in Isaiah 25, when it says, on this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined, and he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. What is that? He will swallow up death forever. That's what he's going to do. He's going to wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. How? By taking their reproach on himself. By spilling the wine of his blood to make that possible. The Lord has spoken. Friends, this water into wine miracle is pointing to who Jesus really is. Jesus has not come to bring condemnation. He has come to bring you joy through relating with God. So here's a question. Do you relate to his gifts or to the giver? Do you see God bringing you this wine, this joy? You see, the problem is people are like, well, how could Jesus do this? How could he make something alcoholic? How could, in fact, even in this text, it says normally this kind of wine is safe for when people are drunk. So it's assumed that people are getting drunk at this wedding. And we're like trying to go through this ethical gymnastics so that we're like, well, Jesus didn't do that. The problem isn't the wine. The problem is that we want the wine more than we want God. That's the problem. And Jesus is there saying, come to me and drink. I am the water of life. I have come to take these reminders of the barrier of what stands between you and your soul-satisfying experience of life. I have come and I'm going to fill them with the wine of celebration, and it's going to happen through his blood. So, John chapter 2. Jesus throws the best parties. He brings the best joy. And then we have this, like, pivot, it seems, in verse 12, when Jesus suddenly turns into this angry man. I'm speaking as a devil's advocate here, okay? Because he goes from this, like, it seems like there's a collision here, a clash between these two portraits that John presents to us in John 2. He's quietly behind the scenes making this abundance of celebration and joy, right? And then here in verse 12 and following, you have him creating a whip and forcibly removing people from the temple. Right? The wedding looks like abundance. The temple looks like disruption. The wedding looks like a celebration, how everybody's getting along and joyful. The temple looks like confrontation. What's going on here? Well, the wedding reveals the joy of God's kingdom, and the temple cleansing reveals the purpose of God's kingdom. These two events are two sides of the same coin. The wedding miracle shows us what Jesus came to bring. He came to bring intimate, joy-filled celebration and relationship with God. And by the way, if that's not how you understand God in relationship, friends, that's what the Bible is showing. And the temple shows us what Jesus came to remove. He came to remove everything that would stand in the way of that intimate, joy-filled relationship. That's what's happening here in John 2. He's writing to show us who Jesus really is. And we might be surprised at this portrait of Jesus being so fierce. And Jesus is fierce because he's responding in this way because of something he sees. You see in verse 14, he sees something going on there. He sees that in the temple, there are these people selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers are sitting there. And then he goes and he makes this cord, this whip, and then he drives them out. And so, at first glance, if you were looking at this, this wouldn't seem to be something going on in the temple that's sinful. Because remember, there's Passover. You see in verse 13, the Jewish Passover was near. So all these pilgrims are traveling in. They're obeying the requirements of worshiping God in Jerusalem. They're at the temple. And they have to buy sacrifices to do that. So people needed these animals. They needed to exchange currency in order to buy what they needed to do these temple sacrifices that were required for them to be obedient Israelites. And the problem isn't what they were doing. The problem is where they were doing it and what this system had become. These outer courts where all this was happening is the only place where the Gentiles could pray. There was restrictions on who could be where in this temple compound. If you were not a Jew, you were restricted. If you were a Jew, you could go in further. If you weren't, closer and closer until ultimately the only person that could actually get into the near presence of God was the high priest, and he could do it once a year. And so what happens here is that this place that should have been known to be a place of encounter with God had become a marketplace, spiritual commerce, replaced spiritual communion. The temple and the sacrifices that took place there, that was God's way of awakening the conscience of worshipers to understand their need to be cleansed and to be brought near. They would need to understand what was going on in that, and so what had happened is in the temple, it had been replaced by a market. It was meant to be a place of encounter, and now it had become a place of commerce. Instead of being a place where they could have quiet heart engagement with God, they were now experiencing this hurried transaction to get through this spiritual errand, as it was. And so John records this to show us something important about who Jesus is and what he's come to do. He has come to bring us joy through experiencing intimate celebration with relationship with God. But Jesus also has come to remove anything that would numb or clutter or replace encountering God. He has come to bring sinners back into a relationship with God. And so the Jesus who brings the joy of celebration, the wine of celebration, is the same Jesus who brings the whip. Because Jesus is not going to let anything that obscures the presence of God remain. He's going to confront it. Anything that would distort your approach to God, anything that would stand between the worshiper and the one worshiped, the living God, Jesus has come to remove that, to make a way open for you, for humans, for sinners to relate with God. It's been said like this: Jesus fills your table with a feast, and he'll also overturn your table for the same reason. He'll fill your table with a feast, Psalm 23, Isaiah 25, Revelation 19. But he will also overturn that table. Why? Because he loves you. You see, we're so familiar with this language, for God so loved the world. We've almost drained it of its significance. Here's the love of God embodied in Christ. Knowing that the wine of celebration for that feast of feasts, for that wedding of weddings, he will accomplish it through nothing less than spilling his blood. And he will overturn every table that gets in the way of you encountering him. He loves you. It's not just sentimentalism. It's not just emotionalism. It's not cheap. It is deep. You see, a false temple of empty religion cannot give true access to God. And that's what he sees going on around him. And he's angry at that. He's fierce against anything that would stand in the way. And so he's upset because they've replaced the living God with a ritualistic system of spiritual errands that doesn't really lead anybody to encounter God. The problem is not wickedness, the problem is emptiness. It's like what Isaiah the prophet said. He says, "This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." Over and over again through the scriptures, from Old Testament all the way through the New, God is seeking the hearts of worshipers, the loves of his worshipers. He has come to satisfy us. You see, they created a temple where experience was, they weren't praying, they weren't repenting, there was no sense of wonder. There was no sense of awe or trembling with the reality of meeting with God. It was busied, hurried transactions to get through these spiritual errands. And I think we need to pause here and let this cut into us. We live in a modern, busy society where we try to be efficient and fit in as much as we can into our schedules. And we try to figure out how to open up a little bit of our life to cram in some experience with God and try to compress it in. And can we get this done between 10 and 12 on a Sunday? And yet we go through life with the wine glass empty all the time. And we go through the motions of hurried spiritual transactions without our hearts truly engaging and encountering a God who spilled his blood because he loves you. You see, a Christianity of busyness without intimacy is not what God has come to bring us. A schedule filled with spiritual activity, but a life that is not having communion is not what God has come to bring us. Jesus overturns the tables in our lives not to harm us, but to heal. I wonder where you need to be healed. Jesus cleanses this temple, and then they confront him and say, "How dare you?" You see this? I mean, they didn't say it in those so many words, but they reply, you know, they're saying in verse 18, "Prove to us, what credentials?" It's almost like, "Show me your badge, Jesus." Like, I want to see who says you can do this kind of stuff. You see in verse 18, "What sign will you show us for doing these things? Prove to us that you have the authority to do what you've just done. Disrupting all of this temple marketplace. Ruining these streams of economy. Disrupting it all. How dare you?" And Jesus answers in verse 19, you say this, you see it? "Destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days." Like, what? Again, this is when you're doing your morning Bible reading and you're like, "Oh, okay. Have fun with that, Jesus." Because it took decades to build this temple. You see, Jesus is not just bringing the wine of celebration. He's not just turning over the tables to remove obstacles. Jesus has come to bring the true temple. He is the true temple. Cleansing the temple isn't merely a moral reform he's after. That's not what's going on here. He is proclaiming, he is declaring his identity, that he has the authority to do this. Because you see in verse 21, he was speaking about the temple of his body. That's why the strand in the very beginning of chapter 2, when he's like, "My hour is not come," what is he thinking about? What he has come to accomplish through his great saving acts. That's what he's thinking. He is this temple. So you say, well, what does Jesus mean? Jesus is saying, he is the one. He is now the place where heaven and earth will meet. That's what a temple would do. It would bring heaven and earth together, encountering God. The Shekinah glory in the Ark of the Covenant. He is the place where sins are forgiven. All these sacrifices we're pointing to. He is the place where God dwells. What the Ark of the Covenant was there. He is the covenant. He brings the new covenant in his blood. He is the place where you draw near to God. And so at Cana, in that wedding, Jesus replaces ritual cleansing with wine, with those stone vessels. And at the temple, he replaces ritual sacrifice with himself. With himself. He doesn't give them a new religious order to go through, or process, or system. He says, "I'm here." He is the fulfillment of Isaiah's vision in Isaiah chapter 12. I know, like, why are we talking about Old Testament stuff? Because this is who God is presenting himself to us all through the Scriptures. I want you to feel the force of the prophets even speaking about this. He says, "Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. With joy, you will draw water from the wells of salvation." You see, people were going to the temple, but they weren't drawing water out of the well. Jesus came to bring that joyful wine of celebration, and he's brought that so that they could understand who he is and bringing God with him. He is God with us. You see, we cannot understand the wedding or what happens in the temple apart. We need to understand them together. At Cana, Jesus reveals the joy of salvation, and at the temple, Jesus reveals the cost. If you want that wine of celebration that's talked about in this wedding feast of Cana, you've got to receive the cleansing. If you want the joy, you've got to let him destroy all the false temples and the false reliance and the self-atonement and the self-righteousness in your life. You see, coming to Jesus for salvation is not just repenting of all of your bad things. It also includes repenting of every time you've tried to save yourself by your good things. And understanding that Jesus is everything. So I wonder what tables need to be overturned in our life. Maybe it's a mechanical religion. Maybe we're just like a version of that here. We're not going to the money changers, so to speak, but it's some modern version of that in your own heart. Are you going through motions and not really encountering God? Is your spiritual life more of a market than a temple? Is it busy? Or maybe it's self-righteous. You see, religion just can produce that. We can fall prey of it. We could be people that say yes about Jesus, we love Jesus, we worship Jesus, and yet you live Monday through Saturday trying to work yourself back into right living with God, as if it's all up to you. You're on this treadmill of religion. Are you trusting in your performance? Are you trusting in buying the right animal, exchanging the right currency? Or maybe there's competing joys. There's these other wells that you're drawing, trying to find the wine of life out of. What wells have left you thirsty? Jesus is not two different persons. He is one person in one mission, to bring you into joyful, life-giving communion with God. At Cana, he shows us the life he has come to give, one of abundance, one of extravagance, one of the best. The best is yet to come. You think you've tasted the wine of life? Oh, friend, you haven't. Jesus has it. And at the temple, he shows us the obstacles that he came to remove. So you say, well, what are we supposed to do? It's simple as this. Come to Jesus. Come to him. If you don't know him as your Savior, if he's just this religious figure with wise sayings that somehow requires the moral life, you've missed who Jesus is. Come to him. He is the feast. He is the true temple. Let him clear the way. Maybe you are a Christian and you've lost sight of who Jesus really is. Let him cleanse out those cluttered places in your life. Let him remove whatever stands between you and truly encountering intimacy with God. Because the wine is too good. The feast that God promises is too glorious. The bridegroom that has come to give that to you is too loving. The joy that he offers you there is too great to settle for anything less. That's John chapter 2.